Okay, we're just coming up on 7:30 here, so as per usual, I'm going to mute all. Everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment. And in particular tonight, because I'm running the whole show, I may not be monitoring the chat as closely as normal, so please do feel free to unmute yourself and jump in, interrupt me if necessary. We're about to see just how valuable Alan is to the running of Q&A, because at least for the first half hour, we're not likely to have him here. His power is supposed to be restored by 8 p.m., so he may be joining us a little bit later. I did put out the agenda on the announcement list, and there's a couple of items on that that I'm going to pass on, at least originally, because I either don't understand what Alan had for those slides, or I think he can do a better job of it. So we may revisit those later if he joins us, or if we have time, we can see if I can come to some sort of understanding about what it's all about. So I think we'll go ahead and get started. So welcome all again to Q&A. As always, we welcome guests. If you want to become a member, by all means, check out our website. There is a link where you can sign up. Okay, let's go ahead and get started. So this was one that Alan actually had, but I think I understand it, so we'll go through it. This is a follow-up. He had a problem where Excel was saving to OneDrive, and he had this option that was on the toolbar that he put there. It's a quick access toolbar of autosave. And it somehow got toggled on, and he objected to the fact that it was auto-saving, and he wanted to save just when he wanted to save. So he suggested that you actually add this to the quick access toolbar if it's not already there, that it is already there. And what you should do is toggle off auto-save or put it in the state you want it to be on, and then remove it from the quick access toolbar so that you you don't accidentally toggle it. So he found that it was still saving to a local OneDrive folder as opposed to his preferred location. So he prefers to locate all his files on the D drive, and the files were being saved to user's toaster, which is his username, OneDrive, which is the default location for OneDrive folder that gets synchronized with the cloud. And he discovered that you can disable that by going into the Excel options, and you go to the Save tab on the left, and then turn on Save to Computer by default. So if you have that turned off, it's going to default to saving it to the OneDrive. And if you toggle that on, then when you do a Save or a Save As, it will come up by default to the local computer. So he suggests doing that. This follow-up came courtesy of Wayne Houston. We had some discussions last week about UPSs, and there was some discussion about how long UPS batteries last, and they do have a finite life to them, and at some point you do have to replace either the entire unit or the batteries themselves. And Wayne let us know that you can go to Total Battery, which has two locations in town, Nepean on Bentley Road, and then out in the east end off New Market Street. And the website is listed on there. And what they suggest is that you bring in your old battery, and they will look at it, check out the specs of it and so forth, and make sure that you get a proper replacement for it. I've used Total Battery for other purposes, and they've always been really stellar in their ability to come up with appropriate replacement batteries for things. So if you're interested in knowing about replacing UPS batteries, you might want to check out Total Battery. This is a follow-up talking about, this was a question that came around talking about faxing for the PC for free. And so this is one of Alan's slides, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about it, but he did a bit of research on it, and he found that LifeWire had an article on 7 free online fax services. So you could check that out. PC Magazine has an article, Best Online Fax Services for 2023. And then LifeWire, they have the 7 free online fax services that are available. And in looking at all of the different services, Alan discovered that most of the free services out there do have some limitations on it. So typically it'll be limited in the number of outgoing faxes or the number of pages that can be attached to any given fax. Generally, they don't allow you to receive faxes, so it's a send-only service. And you might find that they actually put ads on the cover page. So this is part of the price of having a free, quote-unquote, free service. And then many of the free services have a trial period as opposed to being totally free. So some of the ones that he researched there, Fax Plus, they had 10, and he puts in question mark in parentheses 30 with a question mark pages, one time only, that you can only use it. So that's pretty useless. And reason why he has the 3 or 30 is sort of in that screenshot you see below, where they say total page limit is 3 or 25 pages. And I guess he didn't look into what makes the difference as to whether you're on 3 or 25. Fax 0 has 3 or 25 and a maximum of 5 faxes per day. And HelloFax has 5 pages, and I guess in any one fax, and for lifetime. So there are a number of differences that are available in different services. So if you're interested in doing this for free, certainly check it out, because you're going to have to decide whether you can live with their restrictions or not. This is another option that Alan came across, and I think that the limitations of this may make it that it's not appropriate for very many. There is the ability to do internet faxing from Microsoft 365 or Microsoft Office, and it allows you to send directly from the main applications, Outlook, Word, Excel, or PowerPoint. You can actually send to a fax directly. Now, it does require a Windows fax printer driver or the fax services to be installed, which is free. But this, I think, is a pretty severe limitation on it, that you need both a modem and a landline in order for this to actually function properly. So I presume that that is a fax modem and a landline. So the URL, again, this will go up on our website, so you can check that out if you are interested in checking out any of those services. And I see Michelin says she uses Fax Zero. And okay. Okay. So this is a follow-up I have from March 3rd. We had a Q&A where B had a friend whose Chrome browser all of a sudden stopped working. And the reason why this happened was because Chrome system requirements, they had it that the last version of Chrome that worked with Windows 7 was version 109, and that was prior to that particular date that it stopped working. So it no longer worked. So we were talking about it somewhat, and I think the general consensus was that the best solution to get around this problem was to actually upgrade to Windows 10 or 11, which you can do for free. So as long as your hardware supports it, Windows 10 should be no issue. Windows 11 has more stringent hardware requirements for sure, and anybody who's on Windows 7, I'd be willing to bet that their computer can't handle Windows 11. But certainly Windows 10 would be an option, and you can do it for free. And we had the URL to a web page that talked about how you go about doing that. There was an idea floated about staying with an older version of Chrome that still runs on Windows 7. And the question was, really, should you do that? No, I think is the proper answer for that. For one thing, browsers are notorious for having flaws that do get fixed, but if you're sticking with an older version, those flaws are never going to be fixed. And attackers are pretty likely to try to target Windows 7 users that are trying to use the last supported version of Chrome. as well, it was kind of difficult to actually stick with an older version of Chrome and not have it automatically updated to the latest version. So the idea was that it's better to use a supported browser if you're going to stick with Windows 7. And as of that date, there were at least the Opera, Firefox, and Vivaldi browsers that were still supporting Windows 7. And I commented at that time that they're all likely to drop support for Windows 7 at some point in time, so you may be just delaying the inevitable.
You may also be able to use the portable version of Chrome because it will have less dependencies on the registry. And there is a portable version of Chrome, at least through portableapps.com.
Yeah, and it's not going to get updated automatically either. So, yeah, that's actually not a bad idea if you really wanted to stick with that. But
actually the portableapps.com will update it as it changes.
Oh, okay. So that you'd have to take steps to prevent that from actually updating if that was your aim and this to still be able to use it under Windows 7. So can you disable that easily in portable apps that you can say for Chrome, don't do an update to it ever?
Well, you choose when you are using portableapps.com. It will, when you start up portableapps.com, it will tell you what programs need updating, which have updates available for it, and then you choose which to update.
Oh, okay. That's not bad then. You can just avoid updating Chrome in that instance. But again, you're going to be using an older version of it that's going to be buggy.
No, I disagree. I think it may be otherwise. Because it is portable, that means that it doesn't have any registry interaction, and therefore it may be compatible with many versions of Windows because there's less interaction with the internals of Windows.
Okay. But it's entirely possible that the latest version of Chrome, even though it's a portable version, it's entirely possible that it won't run on Windows 7. I don't know what they're doing to check to see. It's an arbitrary thing, I'm sure, that they've decided all of a sudden that version of Chrome, that it no longer runs on Windows 7. You know, fundamentally, the registry itself didn't change. It's just they decided that they're not going to let you run it on Windows 7. So it may work, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if it doesn't. You're sort of, you know, skirting around a problem, trying to come up with a solution that maybe you're better off, not worrying about it. And in the case of Chrome, there are other browsers that you could use. I personally am not particularly married to one particular browser. I use Chrome as my default browser, but I use Firefox, I use Opera, I use Edge, so I don't think people should really be worried all that much about what browser they're using. So I did come across this, and this is the reason for this follow-up, is that on Bugzilla, which is where Mozilla, it's a forum for Mozilla applications and so forth. And on 2023-03-28, so just a few days ago, Mike Copley, who is a programmer for Mozilla, came out with a statement saying that they won't be ending support for Windows 7, Windows 8, or Firefox until at least the third quarter of 2024. So if you're bound and determined that you want to stay on Windows 7, if you switch to Firefox as your browser, then you can have a completely supported browser on Windows 7 for over another year. So just an update on that, but if you're really bound and determined on that, I still would recommend that anybody who's on Windows 7 consider trying to do a free upgrade to Windows 10. You'll be on a supported operating system, and you will run into fewer of these sort of things where an app decides that, oh, we're not going to run on your particular operating system. Okay, onward. This one is from Stuart, and he came across this issue and flagged it for Q&A. So, Digu, we talked recently about them and their policy changes, which meant you couldn't use it on a desktop browser, and they were reducing the amount of free space you got and things like that. So he decided that he wanted to remove all his files from Digu and delete his account. And it turns out that Digu still had access to his Google account, and deleting the app from his Android phone wasn't good enough. You also have to remove access from Google account. And for that, you end up going to account.google.com, and you can actually turn it off there. Now, the next point I added in, I don't think it's as critical as you might think it to be, because the authentication from the app is still required. So even though you've deleted the app, no other app can just automatically decide to access your Google account. It has to be authenticated to your Google account. So as long as your authentication is kept secret to only you, which certainly should be, then it's not a problem that some other app is going to be able to, you know, go in as you, you know, Digu on another device and access your Google account. So if the app has been deleted, there shouldn't be any access because that was the app that was authenticated. But there is a point of why leave around any of these loose ends. So in order to do that, you go to account.google.com. On the data and privacy section, you scroll way down to apps and services, and there's a line there for third-party apps with account access. And so say, for example, I had given access to KeePass to Android, which I've done on my KeePass to Android password safe. I've given access on my phone to be able to access my account. Say I wanted to remove it. So I would click on that, and then it lists off the apps that have access to my account. And I actually have three of them. I have the Google Assistant for Lenovo Smart Clock. So this is my smart alarm clock, has access to my account, and it has full access to my Google account, which kind of makes sense because I can have it read off my calendar items. I can have it read my email. I have it, you know, it can do various things on my behalf. I have KeePass to Android password safe, and it has access to Google Drive. The reason why it has that is because I keep my actual encrypted password safe on Google Drive. So, of course, KeePass to Android password safe needs to be able to access that file in order to be able to update it and synchronize between my desktop and my phone. And then I have Mozilla Thunderbird, and, of course, it needs access to Gmail, my calendar, and contacts. So it makes sense. So if I wanted to remove access to KeePass to Android password safe, I just click on it, and then it lists off in more detail what access it has, when you set it up, and things like that. And then you can just click that blue button, remove access, and then that app no longer has access to your account. So that's it for that. Jeff happened to mention here, there was a special price on Digu through software on sale, $99 for 1 terabyte lifetime. My only question would be how long they're really going to be around. Very good price for 1 terabyte lifetime subscription. Yeah, I saw that too, and they have periodic deals that I've seen on Digu in various things like that. And I was tempted, but then I thought, well, do I really need a terabyte? Right now, I'm living with a couple of cloud services that are free, and they provide me with, I guess, a total of about 25 gigs right now, which for my needs, you know, it's enough. So I thought, well, why bother? You know, even spending the $100, I don't think I really need that. But yeah, if people need, keep an eye out for it, because it seems to come and go periodically. So if you go to the software on sale, keep an eye out, and you probably pick up fair size cloud storage for a reasonable price for a lifetime. Okay, moving onward. So next one is a better media creation tool. This is going to be of interest mostly to the more geeky people in the group here. Not many people actually use the media creation tool in order to create install media for Windows. And it's mostly people that are installing on a multiple computers, or there's a very specialized reason why you need to do this. There is, in some circumstances, where people will do an update that they will be just taken through Microsoft's normal update process. Say if you're upgrading from Windows 7 to Windows 10 or Windows 10 to 11, you'll end up creating this probably, or you may, depending on the path you take. And you don't need to know about this better media creation tool, because the process Microsoft has defined for you will work quite smoothly. So, but for people who know what this is about, creating media for other installations and so forth, you might be interested in this. So the Microsoft Media Creation Tool, they have a separate one for Windows 10 and Windows 11, and the URLs are there on screen. And it allows you to create an installation on a flash drive, which has to be a minimum of 8 gigabytes. You can do it on DVD. But because it requires minimum of 8 gigabytes, it has to be a dual-layer DVD. So based on that, I would suggest that most people would probably want to use the flash drive approach. If you happen to have a computer that, I can't imagine being in a situation where you'd be on a computer that can't boot from a flash drive, but the DVD option is there if it is dual-layer. And then you can use that to install either Windows 10 or Windows 11, depending on which URL you went to. The limitations on that are that it's architecture dependent. So there are versions for ARM as well as x86 CPUs. And there's only a limited set of Windows editions that are available through the Microsoft's officially sanctioned method. So this gentleman created a better version. And when you run his program, you download and you select whether it's Windows 10 or Windows 11. You select ARM or x64, and then you can select a language, and then you can select what version of Windows it is, and you say generate, and then it'll actually chug away for a while. It'll create an ISO file that you can then burn to a flash drive or whatever. So after you download the ISO file, the Microsoft Media Creation Tool is better in this regard, because it can actually write directly to a bootable flash drive, but this one doesn't. So it creates the ISO file. You can double-click the file in Windows File Explorer. It'll open up as virtual drive. You can directly access all the setup files inside and so forth. Or you can actually make a bootable flash drive from that ISO file using a third-party tool. These are two that are available free of charge. So Rufus has been around for many, many years. Capable program, well-respected, been around for a long time. And ImageBurn is another one that will allow you to create a bootable flash drive from that ISO file. So if anybody has a need for something more flexible than Microsoft's Media Creation Tool, check it out. This one I'm not sure I have a lot of information on, but Stuart, you can chime in if you know more than I do on this. So Stuart came across this, and he says, would you like to know everything you should be doing online? So Consumer Reports actually has a pretty comprehensive website that you can go through, and it will give you all kinds of information on best practices in terms of keeping yourself safe online. So you come to this, and it tells you basically what it's going to be able to do, look at, you know, backing up your files, browsing without tracking, avoiding phishing, preventing identity theft. So all these good things that you want to do to be able to protect yourself online. And then you go through and you say, okay, what is it you're trying to protect? And so you select whether you're on Chromebook or you're on Windows computer, you're on an iPhone or an Android phone. Select all of the ones that apply to you, and then you go to the next. And then what is it that you're actually trying to accomplish? So you want to protect yourself online, or you want to avoid phishing scams, or you want to lock down your media, your social media profile. Whatever it is, you choose them all, and then you go the next. And then which of these statements are true? So you just answer it. You know, I want to learn about shielding my identity, you know, or I'm concerned about online harassment, stalking. Check off all the ones that are appropriate to you. Click on the get results, and then it'll come up with a number of action plans. So in this case here, with what Alan had suggested or checked off, it came up with 18 tips, and then you could download a PDF on that. Or, you know, they say you can sign up for a free Consumer Reports account. I'm not sure what benefits you get from that, but at any rate, the options are there for you. Stuart, did you have anything more to add to that? No? Okay.
There, you know, just that it was incredibly comprehensive. You know, and every year there's sort of an annual, everybody's saying, well, we've got to clean up our digital accounts and check that everything is safe and secure. Usually around tax time, this sort of thing happens.
Right.
And this just seemed like such an amazing multi-device, multi-platform, multi-idiot sort of cover everything.
Yeah. The other thing I think that, yeah, the other thing I think that, that looked good is that it looks like it's really aimed at, you know, it's not aimed at techies. So it's aimed at the ordinary computer user who wants to protect themselves online. So if you know other people, you know, even if some of this may be basic to you, you may know other people that, you know, are not part of a user group or don't have expertise in the using of the devices and could use some of this information on how to protect themselves online. I'm always happy to find information at a very basic level that I can pass on to other people.
Yeah, I didn't want to say it was like safe computing for dummies, but that is kind of the approach it takes without using that copyrighted term.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I always thought that that was interesting, all these the books, you know, the For Dummies books that came out, and I thought that, that seems rather insulting somehow. But they were extremely popular. And so, and
They've proven their worth despite the slap of the title.
Yeah, a little pejorative there, I guess.
It's like everything. It had its time as being cute and funny, and now it's a little bit insulting, but it's still valuable.
Exactly. So, yeah, thanks very much for that, Stuart. I think that's a really great resource.
You're welcome.
Okay.
It's accessible.
Oh, yeah, accessible, yeah. And I have more slides on here, it seems. So this is going through and finding those 18 articles and giving you more information about them. So, yeah, really good site. Okay, the next one is one from Alan, and this one was a thing called peppering. And where this comes from is actually salting. So when you're doing public key encryption or when you're a website, this isn't public key encryption, but when a website is storing your password, when you create an account and you create a password and they have to store it, they encrypt it, but they also should salt it, which means that they add additional information to the password when it is encrypted, and when it is decrypted later on, that extra information gets added in so that it decrypts properly. What this means is that, in particular, anybody who chooses short passwords, this creates an incredibly long password that ends up being used as the final thing, and it's much harder for people to crack. So peppering came from that, where it's actually at the client end as opposed to the server end. So I have suggested in the past using a password manager, and certainly once you get beyond half a dozen passwords, which we probably all have, I know I have dozens and dozens of them, you can't remember them all. And you really shouldn't just write them down and put them on a sticky when we all know the proper place for a password is actually under the keyboard, right? So if for anybody who doesn't get it, that's just a joke. You shouldn't write down your passwords and put them in a place where anybody else could find them. So password managers are great. You can get them for free, and they do a very good job of encrypting all your account information on multiple sites, and you just have to remember one very strong password that you create that unlocks the entire password manager. So when you're logging on to websites and you're creating accounts, sometimes what they will do is they will say, we want you to create these question and answer pairs so that if you forget your password, we can recover it by asking you this secret question. And, of course, only you know the secret answer. And it'll have things like favorite food, which apparently about 50% of the people in North America will use pizza as favorite food. So it's not all that secure. Or what's your mother's maiden name? Well, that probably is discoverable. What school did you grow up in? Well, if you're on social media, you might have, you know, at some point you talk about the school you were in and things like that. So a lot of these answers to security questions, it's not good to answer correctly. So what I suggest is that you use nonsense answers to security questions, such as if it's favorite food, maybe it's blue pizza lover, or maybe it's, housing unit. Just totally nonsense things. And then record those in your password manager. It's not very often you actually have to resort to those password the password recovery questions. And if you do, you can go look it up in your password manager, see what nonsense answer you gave, and put it in at the website at that point in time. So Alan came across this from Gary Sims from Gary Explains, and he suggested peppering as a variant to that. So he says, suppose your password manager gets hacked. So all your passwords would be decrypted. So the attacker would have access to, you know, the site, the login ID, and your password, and they could go in and do whatever they wanted as if they were you, because essentially they are. So he said, what if every time you retrieve a password from the vault and then you enter it in the website, you manually just add a few characters at the end of the string that you don't write down anywhere? And he says that's peppering. It's like salting, where it's the website adds this extra information in with the password, but it's the client side doing it. And so he calls it peppering. So the stored password is a stored password equals a secure password. And then the password, when you enter it into the website, you add in that extra information. So in this case, in the password manager, he puts secure password as what his password is. But his password is actually secure password XYZZY. And so by doing this and never writing that down anywhere, including in your password manager, nobody is going to be able to come up with your password, even if they hack your password manager. So that's the idea behind it. I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea. I'm not going and changing my approach at all. I guess, hoping that my password manager is never going to get hacked. But if you want to add a layer of security, there you go. Let's just see what questions we have lately. Oh, Jeff, going back to the making a bootable flash drive with Rufus, be sure to tell it whether your system is BIOS or UEFI when creating the bootable media. Okay, good point. And Carol says, when you use password manager, do you ever have to change your passwords? Personally, I don't make a point of changing my password unless I think that for some reason it may have been compromised. So maybe I gave it to somebody for a specific purpose, a person that I trust, and I no longer trust that person. I would actually go in and change it. But a strong password doesn't get weak by virtue of age. The only thing that might get weak is if you look at, it used to be considered 8 characters was a strong password. 8 characters is not considered to be a strong password nowadays. And so in cases like that, if you have a password that is just by virtue of the complexity or the length of it, is no longer considered to be secure, I would go and change it to make it more secure. But other than that, if you have a good, strong password, yeah, I wouldn't bother going in and changing it unless you have evidence that it's been compromised. One other place where you might get evidence of being compromised is if the site you're logging into has been hacked. There is a possibility that the password database that they are storing at the website, even if it's encrypted, that if the hackers got access to it, they could do brute force attacks or various other types of attacks on that. They may be able to recover your password. And so in cases like that, I would, if you have evidence of your the site you're logging into has been compromised, I would go in and change your password at that point in time on that site only. And if you want to sign up for it, you can go to Have I Been Pwned, and you can actually put in your email address, and they can show if your email address has shown up in any data breaches and where they showed up. And if you happen to recognize that, you could go and change your password at that site.
For what it's worth, as to the length of passwords, there is a rainbow tables attack that one can make on a Windows password, and it decrypts passwords up to about 20 characters. So I always try to make any of my passwords at least 21 characters or more.
That is a huge rainbow table if it's 20 characters. Big space when if you consider uppercase, lowercase, special characters, and numbers. But yeah, and one of the benefits of using a password manager too is that it makes it easy to log into websites, and so you can live with extremely long passwords. Even if you use it as a copy and paste from your password manager, there are usually automated methods you can use to automatically log onto websites. But even if you do it as copy and a paste, it's no more effort to copy a 40-character password than it is to copy a 10-character password. So you can have extremely long, complex passwords without any pain going through that. Okay. This was a question that came in from Elizabeth Driscoll, and she had this where she's getting this blue oval notification in Twitter, and she can't figure out how to make those go away. And she checked under her options for notification, and that didn't help any. Now, if anybody knows the answer directly to this, by all means, chime in, because what I'm going to be going through on this is I don't actually know the answer to this, but I have a really good solution to using Twitter that I think is better than worrying about whether those notifications occur or not. I don't use Twitter.com. I use TweetDeck.twitter.com. So it's still a website. You don't have to install anything on your computer. And I never see those notifications, and I actually end up with a much more usable interface to Twitter that allows organization of tweets. And we'll go through this, but again, if anybody knows about those notifications, by all means, chime in with that. So if you go to tweetdeck.twitter.com and you are prompted to sign in, just like the regular Twitter account, Twitter website, and after you sign in for the first time, you'll end up with a screen like this saying, let's get you set up, okay? And you just sign in using your normal way you would log into twitter.com. Then you can click on the open display settings, and it gives you an opportunity to modify some of the look and feel of the overall thing. Now, don't worry too much about whether you want to do that or not. You could actually just do the skip this step, or you can do it. You can always modify it later on. You can get to a menu option that gives you this exact dialog box later on. So you can do it in the front, or you can do it later on. So then after you choose that or do the skip, you end up with import your columns or add a starter deck. And so I'm not sure what import your columns actually does. I've never done it. You can add a starter deck, which will pre-configure a couple of the common columns of information, or you can just click on start from scratch, and that's what I'm going to do in these screenshots. So if you start from scratch, you end up with a screen that looks somewhat like this. And so there's no information in there, and all there is add a column. I would suggest first off just clicking on that ellipsis near the bottom, and it has a little bit of more fly out information about where you can customize some things. And it's probably worth doing the take the tour, which is just three screens come up that just show you how to make a column, how to organize your column with DEX, and then some tips and settings. And that's all the information that's in there. There's no, you know, read more detail or anything like that, but it just gives you a really, really brief overview of the interface. So everything in TweetDeck revolves around columns. You need columns to put information into. So you click on the add column, and it'll come up with a selection of things that you can actually have as this particular column. And so, you know, it just does a brief description of your home timeline. Let me just see. Yeah. Okay, so the home timeline is basically the same sort of thing that you get at Twitter.com. So it's the tweets of the people you're following end up coming into that. You can also do lists if you're part of lists, or your messages if you're doing direct messaging on there. You can do profiles where you can look up, you know, somebody else's Twitter account and see their tweets and things like that. Notifications are kind of handy. And things like that. I'll come back to a couple of these later on. But you can just experiment with these different ones. You can also search. So you can search for an example of a hashtag, and the results of that search will be put into a column that every time you go into TweetDeck, it will actually show you that column with that information in it. So kind of cool. So you can add many columns. So here I have actually four columns. So I have the home tab, home column on the left, and that's the tweets from the people that I follow. And it's just like the regular Twitter.com, where most recent is at the top, and you can see here I've got a bunch of tweets from various people that I'm following. The next one over is a profile of another user. So what I've done is I've created a column for the Ottawa PC user group. So that column will always be visible, and it will show all of the tweets that are made by Ottawa PC User Group. And I can see here that not only is it the see the tweets, I could actually click on the other tabs here so that I could see replies, media likes, and things like that. So that allows me to keep tabs on some other Twitter user. Next one over is notifications, and I find this really, really useful. When somebody retweets one of your tweets or likes one of your tweets, or when somebody starts following you, you will actually see a notification come into this column. So I like to keep tabs on, you know, when somebody does retweet me or like my tweets and things like that. Or in particular, if somebody's following me, it's kind of nice to have it come up in my face that I can see, you know, that this has occurred. And then the last one is where I searched on a hashtag. So in this case, I searched on a hashtag of InfoSec for information security. And so that column will show me all of the tweets that go out that include that particular hashtag. And you can see that this one is a pretty active one. The top tweet was 27 seconds previous to that, 31 seconds, 1 minute. You know, so this is a hashtag that probably would not be something that I really want to do because there's so much activity on it, but it gives you the idea of how that particular search on a particular hashtag could be turned into a column and just have that information updated for you all the time. So I find TweetDeck to be a lot better useful tool than Twitter.com, and I never see those notifications that was being complained about. So do we have, just going back, I guess, to the original message, does anybody have an idea about why you see that see new tweets and a way to get rid of that? I don't see anything yet in the chat, so we'll carry on. Oh, yeah. Okay. There was a little bit more information I had in here. So you can customize the column somewhat as well. So if you hover the mouse over top of the top right-hand corner of a particular column, it'll actually pop up with these three icons. So the left one is to delete the column. So this is where you can easily experiment with columns because you can just get rid of them if you don't like them. So you can delete the column by just clicking on that. The center one will change your order, so it'll just toggle between top tweets, which is way Twitter has decided that what's most important, or do you just want latest tweets first? I usually just do it latest tweets first. And then you have column settings. And if you choose that, you'll get this flyout menu where you can choose what this column should default to for the tweet order, whether you want it to refresh automatically or whether you have to force a refresh as new tweets come in. You can choose from three widths of the columns. And then media preview size. I'm not exactly sure what that really is all about. I just leave it at the standard. I've never played with the small. And then you can actually rename the column and things like that. They say you can move the column to another deck. And the decks, I don't go into it in this presentation, but the decks are where you can have actually multiple sets of columns. And then you can just call up its different deck for a different purpose and things like that. The other thing I didn't cover is that if you hover the mouse over top of this icon, you can actually use that to drag the columns to change the order. Okay. The next one on here, we had a question come in from Ron on how do I get rid of a pop-up? And so he gets this message every time his computer reboots and it goes into Windows that Windows cannot access the specified device path or file. You may not have the appropriate permissions to access the item. And he tried to access that particular directory or file in order to delete it. And it appeared that you can see in the title of this, it says, you know, Windows apps, Microsoft, your phone, and it appeared before he even had a cell phone. He does have a cell phone, but he wants to get rid of this particular pop-up message. So the reason why you can't access it is that the folder C:\Program Files\Windows Apps, it is hidden and protected. It is the location, the default location for all Microsoft Store apps. And you can access it as an administrator, but I highly recommend that you don't. Don't mess around directly with the files and folders that are underneath Windows apps, the Microsoft Store apps files. It's a very convoluted structure that is under there, and you can very quickly and easily break a particular app by going in and messing with the files in there. So we know it's a Microsoft Store app because the title of it says C:\Program Files\Windows Apps. So this particular one that is being talked about here is under that hierarchy. And it identifies the actual specific app. So in this case, it's Microsoft.yourphone. It is not always the vendor followed by the name. It can be various things. In Microsoft's case, they almost always, but not even always for Microsoft, they have Microsoft dot and then something identifying the particular store app. You might have to Google for it. In this case, your phone, it actually equates to Microsoft's phone link app. So rather than calling it phone link, I think they used to call it your phone, and they renamed it or rebranded it to phone link. But they left the directory structure for it the same. So what I want to do at this point is then I go into Settings, Apps, and Installed Apps and search for Phone. And if it's not there, what I would suggest you do is actually install Phone Link from the Microsoft Store, and that will probably fix that pop-up message because there must be something corrupted underneath there that is making it so that you're getting this pop-up message. So if you just install over top of it, then presumably it'll install it correctly and the pop-up message will go away. Now, if it is installed, you'll actually see it come up, phone link. And what I would do is click the ellipsis. And if you're in Windows 10, there is no ellipsis. You just click anywhere on that line where it says phone link. And it'll come up with a pop-up menu. And one of the options is advanced options, and I click on that. And then I wouldn't bother, under the reset section, I wouldn't bother with the repair. Repair is useful if you have a bunch of data that has already been you're working with in this particular app or configuration options and things like that, and you want to preserve those, try the reset first. But in this case, he hasn't been using this particular app. So just do a reset. What a reset will do is it'll reinstall the app to its default settings. And so I would click the reset, and that'll probably fix the pop-up message. Jeff says, after you install PhoneLink app, you cannot uninstall it without using PowerShell. Not true. I'll show you in a second. I posted something about that in the members forum. We'll see if I can find it. Don't bother. I got a better solution for you. Uninstalling PhoneLink. So you'll notice that when you do that drop-down list on PhoneLink, that move and uninstall are grayed out. So in a mini rant, so Microsoft prevents removal of many, many of the built-in apps that come with Windows, and the uninstall is grayed out. So even if you find that this is a particularly useless app and you don't want it taking up space on your computer or potentially using your internet connection or who knows what, and you want to get rid of it, Microsoft wants to prevent you from doing it. CCleaner is an app that you can install from www.ccleaner.com, and it can uninstall any Microsoft app. So here you see in the interface where under the tools on the left-hand column, I went to the top option. Oh, I should have actually had another box around here. You want to go to uninstall, and then it'll list all of your apps, and you'll notice that even a store app like PhoneLink, it's available for uninstall. You click on the uninstall, and it will remove it for you. So I highly recommend CCleaner for anybody who is trying to get rid of apps that Microsoft doesn't want to let you uninstall. However, caution, don't uninstall Microsoft Store. Okay, it's a catch-22. Microsoft Store is a Microsoft Store app. If you uninstall it, you will no longer be able to install any apps from the Microsoft Store, including you won't be able to install the Microsoft Store app because you need the Microsoft Store app to install the Microsoft Store. So that's one that I would never remove. If you accidentally do remove it, there is a way through PowerShell that you can actually force an install of the Microsoft Store app itself. So, but just stay away from that one. And that is the end of what I had. There were a couple of other things, but I think that in the interest of the fact that we're into the last 10 time frame, Alan has not joined us, so I guess he is still without power. And I think rather than going through the three items that I skipped over, we'll push those off to the next Q&A, which will be in 2 weeks. And they will be on Passkey, Fungo, and there was one other one. And Linda has a short presentation as well, so we'll push those off. So now that we're into the final 10, does anybody have any additional questions or so forth? And Jess says, okay, that's okay. So Jeff pasted in the PowerShell command to uninstall PhoneLink. So if you want to do it through that way, but I would suggest it's a lot easier to just go and use CCleaner, which also has some additional capabilities. I would look through the past Q&As on CCleaner. I have some cautions about using it for other cleaning duties, but it is it's really, really good app for being able to clean up a lot of stuff off your computer.
For what it's worth, one comment, this doesn't have anything to do with PCs, but I bought a ring light quite cheaply on Amazon a little while ago. It runs on USB, and it's lighting me right now with about 1.7 amps or about 8 or 9 watts. It's providing me a little bit of light in the darkness.
Oh, I see. Yes, of course, you're in darkness. Yeah, very good. Yeah, I thought your lighting was a little harsh tonight, but actually it's better than no light. So do we have any other questions or comments? I will go move on to the other stuff, but let's, because we have the wrap-up slides, which I'll start through. but
hang on.
Yep.
Yeah, hang on. Carol asked a question about 4G and 3G cellular service back
at the start
of the chat.
Yeah,
my apologies. I wanted to ask her. She said that she traveled to the States and lost phone service. And I just wanted to ask her what her carrier or who her carrier is.
I was using Videotron.
Okay.
And I didn't know there was that the U.S. had gone straight, I guess, 4G or 5G.
Yeah, they dropped 3G a little while ago.
And as soon as I crossed the border, I couldn't dial anything, not even Videotron. So
yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah, I noticed on a couple carrier websites, usually the flanker brands like Fizz and Kudu and Fido, they have some 3G plans, and they're advising any of their customers to buy some kind of 4G service if they're traveling into the States ahead of time. Or, you know, you can get different international SIM cards that are good for whatever. There's a lot of options.
Videotron was able to make a change when I got to my destination. I called them. And they were able to make a change to the phone, and then I was able to check what LTE.
Yeah.
And then it worked. But there's something in the phone that they had to change or something.
Well, Videotron is a 5G capable carrier, but they also have 4G, and I assume some of their services may be 3G. I don't know for sure, but if your service was somehow a 3G service in the Ottawa area, you were fine until you crossed the border where there was none of that around. But none of the carriers were being very proactive about telling their customers about it, except putting a little note on their websites.
Yeah. One thing you should watch for too is some carriers, like I'm with Virgin and I'm on a really, really cheap plan and it's 3G speeds. And so I think what it really is, it's on 4G network, but they're just throttling it to 3G speeds to provide something cheaper.
Yeah. And in your case, if you were to travel to the States, maybe it would be fine, maybe not, but it'd be worthwhile checking.
Yeah, that's true. I could check with Virgin on that and just say, yeah, if I do start roaming, am I going to have problems?
Do I need a spare SIM?
Yeah, good point. Good point.
Because I know I've been thinking of going to Fizz.
Or will I be overcharged?
Yeah. Well, you're going to be overcharged. That's a given.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Thanks, Carol, and thanks, Sue, for picking up on that one in the chat. We will have a little bit more time, a couple minutes, but just to do the wrap-up slides, a reminder, next week is our April main meeting, so we will not be having a Q&A on that night, and the presentation is going to be Stefan Richard, who's going to be talking about all of the innards of how computers do calculations and things like that, and my phone is... Turn that off. So no Q&A on April 12th. And so if you have something for Q&A, it'll be April 19th. It'll be the next meeting. So send in your questions, answers, and topics to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. And with that, we are coming up on 8:29. So if there are any last questions or comments or anything like that, please feel free to unmute yourself. Or whatever. Other than that, we are done for the evening. Thanks very much for everybody showing up. We had a total of 22 participants tonight, so that's pretty good considering that there are probably a bunch that couldn't join us because of power problems. And we will see you next week at the general meeting.
Yeah, and Bob Walker here. In the past, I've given presentations on backup power, and last week I gave a presentation on uninterruptible power supplies. As a result of my experiences today, I'll do some updates on at a future Q&A.
Good stuff. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Chris, for your suggestions on that pop-up window.
Okay. Hope it works for you.
Yeah. So do I.
Yeah, it really is a matter of don't mess with things underneath that particular directory structure. If you're curious, you can go in as an administrator and you can access files, but I wouldn't touch any of them. It's really quite convoluted and the files are not very understandable to mere humans. And I suspect just deleting anything underneath there will probably cause you even more grief. Okay, good night all.